Hello and welcome to Learning College and VNN Audiobooks, Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to start a new book. It's called The International Jew. And this is a pretty famous book that was put out, made up of articles from the Dearborn Independent, the paper owned by Henry Ford. And back in those days, Henry Ford was discovering that Jews were A, organized, and B, immensely domineering and threatful to ordinary Americanism. And he had his staff of writers and editors put out a paper and thoroughly researched Jewish involvement in the world and American life back in the first half of the 20th century. And before the Jews threatened to basically withhold advertising and to destroy his business, Henry Ford was the most prominent American who was willing to publicly criticize the Jews, who were extremely powerful even back then. I was just reading from Culture Wars, E. Michael Jones's magazine, about an American congressman from Oregon who was basically defeated politically by the Jews back in the 40s, and he was complaining about their subversion. The ADL has had a long history since it was formed to defend the pedophile murderer Leo Frank. They basically got his sentence commuted by applying pressure to the governor of Georgia. And after that, Georgians still had enough balls to go ahead and lynch him in Marietta, where he the home of Mary Fagan that he'd murdered. But that was what led to the creation of the ADL, and the ADL worked hand in glove with the FBI, basically legally or illegally collecting information on anyone that the Jews deemed who might become a potential threat, and then feeding those lists over to the FBI. That is what the ADL has always done throughout its entire history. But Henry Ford became aware of the Jews and the problems they were causing. Of course, Henry Ford being the great industrialist who introduced the, $5 a day? Was it $5 an hour? $5 a day pay, which was a huge thing. He overpaid. He paid more because he wanted good workers. But he had his researchers at the Dearborn Independent, again, that's Dearborn, Michigan, compile this book called The International Jew. Now, the Jews went around after they made their deal with him, and they pulped a hell of a lot of the copies of this. It's pretty hard to find. I honestly don't remember. I believe I had two copies of it. I gave one away. I have one that has some water problems. I found this. There's a Judaica section at Sam Weller, a used bookstore, a very large used bookstore in Salt Lake City, where I also found The Ordeal of Civility. I may or may not have gotten this one there. I honestly don't remember. But you can find some more obscure stuff. But this was a book that was printed in the millions and used to be very common. But of course, the Jews don't want any copies of stuff that reveal them for what they are, especially if it's produced by someone who's prominent and publicly admired and respectable. That's why they're so hot to destroy the reputations of men like Charles Lindbergh and Henry Ford and other people who were on the America First Committee that tried to keep us out of World War II. So, anyway, this book is black covered. There's no slip cover. I don't know if there was one originally. Runs 231 pages, average size sort of book. And I think most of the copies you might find today, if you find them, you could probably buy it online, but you'd probably pay a little bit of money. That's one reason I'm hot to get this up. I know there's interest in it. People want to hear about it. This is a very key to an understanding, not only of what Jews are doing, but the fact of the book itself, that a prominent American, this is like as if today, someone like, say, Donald Trump, were to fund an investigation of Jewish power in America, print the results in a series of articles in a newspaper that he owned, and then take all those articles and put them together to make a book out of them. And that was what Henry Ford did, and you could only imagine some great in America doing that today. The Jews would go after him crazily, because even if you dare to support anything that's in any way opposed to one of their agenda items, they will try to smear you and defame you and destroy your reputation. And they've done that to people like Trump, even though Trump was first made rich by a Jew. you have to stay totally on their plantation or they'll come at you. And so this has, The International Jew has 16 chapters. As we open it, okay, The International Jew, the world's foremost problem. Again, this is the number one American industrialist who was later given an award by the Nazi Germany, by Hitler. he's printing a book that says The International Jew is the title. The subtitle is The World's Foremost Problem. The world's foremost problem. Do you think it has become less so since this time? 70, 80 years? No, it's become more so. The Jew remains the world's foremost problem, fomenting wars and debasing the money everywhere it goes and polluting the culture. This is what Jews do, and it's why they have to be wiped out. The International Jew, the world's foremost problem. Abridged from the original, as published by the world-renowned industrial leader Henry Ford Sr. Appearing originally in the periodical published by the Ford Motor Company, the Dearborn Independent. The periodical, I think that was a newspaper, though. Copy prepared, now again, this may not be original, so says, the copy prepared for the printer by Gerald L.K. Smith. That was one that the Jews were hot after. He was on the ADL's hate book, list of people they hate. Gerald L.K. Smith certainly figured. He was the national director of the Christian Nationalist Crusade, P.O. Box 27895, Los Angeles 27, California. I'm sure that address is long defunct, as is Smith, but this copy was prepared for the printer by Gerald L.K. Smith, so this must be a reprint from some point and not the actual original. But still, this is a very old book, as well as being somewhat damaged. And so we will do the... Let's do the introduction and then the Jewish history in the United States. And then that will be enough for this introductory tape. So maybe 20 pages or so. Anyway, that's the background and that's the context this comes out of. This is one of the major businessmen in the U.S. He's come upon the realization Jews are a problem. He's funded research into it. And he's published that research. And he and a lot of other Americans who are also aware of the problem, typically the Lindberghs, father and son, are part of the America First Committee to try to put America interests ahead of British interests and Jewish interests in drawing the U.S. into the war. Okay, introduction. At the apex of his business career, Henry Ford, the industrial genius, sensed that a terrific effort was being made to take his business from him and manipulate it into the hands of the money changers. Remember the way that the Jews stole Walt Disney's characters and stole his technology and defamed him as an anti-Semite. Mr. Ford had the impression that these manipulators were being engineered by powerful Jewish financiers. That is, the Rothschilds behind J.P. Morgan and such. He called to his office the most intelligent research men within his acquaintance. He commissioned them to make a thorough study of the International Jew and publish their findings in the Dearborn Independent, which at that time was the official organ of the Ford Motor Company. No expense was spared, and it is estimated that literally millions of dollars were spent by Mr. Ford on this project. So, Henry Ford, the original articles were carried first in the Dearborn Independent and then published in book form. So, Henry Ford, the premier American industrialist, spent millions of dollars having the Jewish question researched, and what we are going to get are the results. And even though the book is 7 years old, the results are still highly relevant, even more relevant, because Jews have more power now than they had at that time. At that time, there were still a few independent outlets that weren't controlled by Jews, but today there are very few except for those on the internet. Me speaking to you, there's no filter between me and you. No Jew is able to censor. No Jew is paying me not to say things or paying me to say things, and I'm not revealing that fact to you. Rather, you are getting a full and independent report that is my feelings and my reading to you from such sources as I think are important for you to understand what's actually going on in your white world. See, so that is genuinely independent media and education is what we're doing here, and there's very, very little of it out there. Now, awkward to flip these pages because it's like I say, it's kind of damaged. Anyway, this introduction is by Gerald Smith, Gerald L.K. Smith, and he was like a religious white nationalist who was one of the more prominent names back then. He's the one writing this introduction. But anyway, since this is a reprint years after the fact, he's setting it up for us and giving us his context. Smith says, I have in my possession every copy of the Dearborn Independent. This complete set is beautifully bound in Morocco leather and was given to me by an Inner Circle member of Mr. Ford's personal staff. When the report on the International Jew was originally published, it opened each chapter with a text taken from the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, or from the published statements of world prominent Jews. The moment the manuscripts dealing with the Jewish problem reached the public, a terrific howl went up from official Jewry. If I were to summarize the campaign of reprisal and abuse which was carried on against Mr. Ford and his company, this summary alone would require a book. Every instrument of torture and abuse which could be imagined was carried on against Mr. Ford. Smear, character assassination, ridicule, physical threat, boycott. The pressure was constant, consistent, and endless. The most powerful and enigmatic pressures imaginable were brought to bear on Mr. Ford to stop the publication of the International Jew. So the Jews don't want the truth about themselves to be known publicly. That's how destructive they are. Finally, the order came through to cease publication and to destroy the copies which were available. That's why it's so hard to find them. Jews and others went into the bookstores and found and bought and destroyed all copies which could be found. Sneak thieves were commissioned to visit libraries and steal the report out of the libraries. This made the book so rare and unfindable that it became a collector's item. I'm going to pause this and I'm going to look it up and see what I can find on this. Okay, a quick search reveals, first of all, that you can find the International Jew online. I believe we have a copy at VNN Forum. I'm embarrassed. I'm not absolutely positive about that. But if you search it, you can call one up. But also, let's read a little what the Wikipedia, which is a conventional left-wing Jew-controlled so-called information source, says about the International Jew. The International Jew is a four-volume set of booklets or pamphlets published and distributed in the early 1920s by Henry Ford. So again, this is before the Nazis. By Henry Ford, an American industrialist and automobile manufacturer. In spring 1920, Ford made his personal newspaper, the Dearborn Independent, chronicle what he considered the Jewish menace. Every week for 91 issues, the paper exposed some sort of Jewish-inspired evil major story in a headline. The most popular and aggressive stories were then chosen to be reprinted in the four volumes called The International Jew. It is to be distinguished from The International Jew, The World's Problem, which the world's foremost, it should say foremost problem. Or, well, I'll just read what Wikipedia says. The International Jew is to be distinguished from The International Jew, The World's Problem, which was the headline in the Dearborn Independent and is the name of a collection of articles serialized in the Dearborn Independent. It is also to be distinguished from the title of the first volume of the series, namely The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem. That's the one I'm reading out of, so I guess it would be volume 1 of 4. That was what I thought. I just wasn't absolutely positive about it. Anyway, the important thing is not all these little academic bits or the ways it's different. The importance is the same. You're getting the same type of material, no matter if you have the full thing or part of it. It's all talking about Jews as the problem in the world. Not in America, not in Dearborn, Michigan, not to Henry Ford, but the problem in the world. And Henry Ford was clued onto it because the Jews are trying business tricks against him. Now, this is interesting. At the Nuremberg trials, Balder von Schirach, who I believe was head of the Hitler Youth, mentioned that the International Jew made a deep impression on him and his friends in their youth and influenced them in becoming anti-Semitic. He said, quote, "We saw in Henry Ford the representative of success, also the exponent of a progressive social policy. In the poverty-stricken and wretched Germany of the time, early 20s, youth looked toward America, and apart from the great benefactor Herbert Hoover, it was Henry Ford who to us represented America." In 1922, the New York Times reported that Adolf Hitler's office contained a large picture of Ford. A well-thumbed copy of the International Jew was found in Hitler's library. So he actually preceded the Nazis in this thoroughgoing identification of Jews as the problem of problems, the mother of all problems. And Why don't I think I ought to, since it won't be listed in the volume I'm reading from, why don't I, well, just the way that Ford was knocked out of this also matters, even though everything that he found is completely documented and reliably true. 1927 libel suit, a libel suit brought by San Francisco lawyer and Jewish farm cooperative organizer Aaron Shapiro, S-A-A-R-O-N, S-A-P-I-R-O, in response to anti-Semitic remarks, led Ford to close the Independent in December 1927. So he finally closed it after all this pressure, but still, the research is done, the results are there, and they're undeniable, even though Ford later backed off. He only backed off due to pressure, not because his views had changed, and that's how it normally is with people opposed to the Jews. They either end up being killed or successfully defamed, or they grow old and get bad health, or they back off. But the Jews remain doing the same criminal activity they've always done. That's why I say there's no solution to it except to exterminate them. Because there's too many of them, they're too organized. And the people fighting them are not organized, they have no background. They truly, even to get you to understand, so you who are new to this will think that the world's foremost problem is overdrawn, but it's not overdrawn. And it will take you years to understand that. The Jews have been about their business for thousands of years. You're not going to hope to understand and successfully compete with them overnight or even over a couple of decades. Basically, they need to be treated as something that is simply classified as vermin and simply exterminated. That's not a call to go after individual Jews as such. It's saying that that is the only ultimate policy that can work to defeat the Jews, I believe. Anyway, what I'm going to do now, before I go back to our text for this first installment, is simply read through the chapters of the four volumes so that you'll be aware of them all. But anyway, you can find this at Wikipedia, just so we know what we're dealing with. Volume 1, The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problems. Volume 2, Jewish Activities in the United States. The first, okay. The World's Foremost Problem, Volume 1, is 1920. Jewish Activities in the U.S., 21. It's Volume 2. Volume 3, Jewish Influence in American Life, like number 2, that's also 21, and 4, Aspects of Jewish Power in the U.S., 1922. So from 20 to 22, these come out, and they deal with Jews as the biggest problem in the world, and then specifically in the U.S. for the last three problems. I'll read some of the chapter titles. The one that we're going to deal with, The Jew in Character and Business, Germany's Reaction Against the Jew, Jewish History in the U.S., The Jewish Question, Fact or Fancy, Anti-Semitism, Will It Appear in the U.S.? Jewish Question Breaks into the Magazines. Arthur Brisbane Leaps to the Help of Jewry. Does a definite Jewish world program exist? The Historic Basis of Jewish Imperialism. An Introduction to the Jewish Protocols. Jewish Estimate of Gentile Human Nature. Jewish Protocols Claim Partial Fulfillment. Jewish Plan to Split Society by Ideas. Did the Jews Foresee the World War? Is the Jewish Kahal the modern Soviet? How the Jewish Question touches the farm? Does Jewish power control the world press? Does this explain Jewish political power? The all-Jewish mark on Red Russia? Jewish testimony in favor of Bolshevism? Those are the 20 chapters of Volume 1. And I'm not even sure all of them. No, in fact, not all of them are even in the one that I have. The one that I have only has 20 chapters, and it's not the same as those. So obviously there are varying publications. I'll just leave it there. You can find more at Wikipedia if you wish to look it up. Volume 3, The Jew Gamblers Corrupt American Baseball, Jewish Degradation of American Baseball, Jewish Jazz Becomes Our National Music, How the Jewish Song Trust Makes You Sing, Jewish Hotbeds of Bolshevism in the U.S., Jew Trades Link with World Revolutionaries, Jews and Labor Unions, on and on and on, and it's all documented. Now let's just go back to the introduction that we're reading. We'll leave it there. Well, one more. First, we'll see if we can find this online. I believe we can. We'll see what the price is. Yep, right off, I find that not only can you buy this book, you can buy it cheaply, and you can buy it directly from Amazon itself. New, it looks like $5.95. And you can find 10 used. Yeah. Yeah, for under $10, you can get a copy of The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem, but an abridged edition. So I don't know if that's the one I'm dealing with, but clearly it's a much nicer paperback, fresh printed, whereas mine, as I said, is somewhat messed up from time and age. Anyway, having established what's basically going on here, let's go back to the introduction by Gerald L. K. Smith and then the first couple chapters. So Ford had his staff research and print this in the Dearborn Independent, the Ford's paper out of Michigan there. And every instrument of torture and abuse was leveled against Ford until he finally withdrew in 27, about 7 years after this started, I guess. And then Jews went into the bookstores and bought and destroyed all copies they could find. Sneak thieves were commissioned to visit libraries and steal the report out of the libraries. This made the book so rare and unfindable that it became a collector's item, says Smith. The day finally came when one ambition of the Jews was fulfilled. Mr. Ford apologized for publishing The International Jew and blamed subordinates for the deed. That was kind of a cowardly act on his part. In 1940, I interviewed Mr. Ford on numerous occasions. In fact, on the day before his first automobile was put under glass, he and Mrs. Ford invited Mrs. Smith and myself to be their guests at Dearborn. And this is 1940. This would be about 13 years after he had withdrawn publication. On this occasion, he told me the whole story of his first car and how he happened to make it. Among the precious souvenirs which have come to Mrs. Ford and myself is a New Testament autographed by Mr. Ford, and handwritten letters from Mrs. Ford, commenting favorably on some of my speeches and expressing in her own handwriting Mr. Ford's appreciation for my activities. So back then, a great industrialist was not ashamed to associate with a racial cause or one of its leaders, and was not ashamed to put his own money and not afraid to put his own money into backing research against the Jew. This is how dangerous Jews are to whites. Jews anywhere threaten whites everywhere. That's the factual truth of the matter. And not just whites, but really every other race. The other races have scarcely any less interest than whites do in seeing the Jew permanently disestablished. Or dethroned, we should say. It was on the occasion of one of these personal visits with Mr. Ford that he gave me a sensational and shocking report. He said, "Mr. Smith, my apology for publishing The International Jew was given great publicity, but I did not sign that apology. It was signed by Harry Bennett." For the information of the reader, Harry Bennett was a very officious and aggressive employee of the Ford Motor Company. He presumed his way into the confidence of Mr. Ford and later became known as an enigmatic and obnoxious personality. Space will not permit a thorough discussion of the activities of Harry Bennett. Mr. Ford's personal secretary for 34 years, Mr. Ernest Liebold, L-I-E-B-O-L-D, told me that one of the worst things that ever happened to the Ford Motor Company was the employment of Harry Bennett. For a certain period of time, Bennett exerted virtually a dictatorial control over the affairs of the company. His alleged deeds, if summarized, might make a rather scandalous book. When Mr. Ford told me that he had not signed the apology, it seemed almost unbelievable. In fact, I could scarcely believe my own ears. Furthermore, on the occasion of this same visit, Mr. Ford said, "Mr. Smith, I hope to republish The International Jew again sometime." He showed no signs of regret for having published it in the beginning. I did not report this conversation even to my most faithful followers because the original apology had been so thoroughly publicized that I knew it would be difficult to make people believe what I had heard from Mr. Ford's own lips. After Mr. Ford died, the man Harry Bennett evidently was very much disillusioned and embittered by the fact that he did not share generously in the inheritance. He collaborated with a Jew by the name of Paul Marcus in the writing of a book entitled "We Never Called Him Henry." Here is Mr. Bennett's own story concerning the much-publicized apology, quote-unquote, Mr. Ford is supposed to have made for exposing the machinations of the International Jew. Here are Mr. Bennett's own words. This is an extended quote here. Bennett's words. This lousy Ford employee. "I got in touch with Arthur Brisbane, Brisbane, and through him learned that the American Jewish Committee could settle the matter. I entered into negotiations with Samuel Untermeyer and Louis Marshall of that organization, AJC, which preceded the ADL, as in some ways a rival, but also a coeval or a helper. But in any case, was there first. So I entered into negotiations with Samuel Untermeyer and Louis Marshall of that organization, the AJC, and with Brisbane. They drew up the now-famous apology, which was to be the basis for a settlement. In this formal statement, it was said that Mr. Ford would see to it that no more anti-Semitic material circulated in his name, and that he would call in all undistributed copies of the International Jew, which were booklet reprints of the Dearborn Independence articles. For the rest, the apology said that Mr. Ford had no knowledge of what had been published in the Dearborn Independent and was shocked and mortified to learn about it. No doubt the Jews are the ones choosing those adjectives and the general course of play there. So that they have to separate anyone with professional quality or anyone with integrity or anyone of social standing from the views that are so threatening to them, which they call anti-Semitism, but which are simply honest understanding and portrayal of their behavior. They want that to be solely the province of quacks and other people they can portray as losers, so that good people won't associate with them or listen to what they have to say. So it's a very great danger to them when an established person of high social respect with lots of money comes out against them. They can't tolerate that. They will do anything up and including murder to stop that person. You say, why aren't, and then it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy. It sees you can't get good people to associate with this cause because they have something to lose and they know that the Jews will destroy them. There's no way out of this problem except through courage, the courage of individuals. Us producing these broadcasts, you listening to them and telling this truth to other people. That's the only way that the whites will ever get on top of Jews again. There's no way to do it without courage. And there has to be a lot of courage. Otherwise, Jews will continue to ride herd and they will destroy anyone left or right who dares to speak about what they're doing. Arthur Brisbane brought the statement to me, still in the quote, at 1710 Broadway. I phoned Mr. Ford. I told him an apology had been drawn up and added, "It's pretty bad, Mr. Ford." I tried to read it to him over the phone, but he stopped me. So I signed Mr. Ford's signature to the document. I had always been able to sign his name as realistically as he could himself. I sent the statement to Untermeyer and Marshall. The signature was verified and the case was closed. All this was done without Mr. Ford's taking anyone else into his confidence. Edsel knew nothing about it, and Cameron and Senator Reed heard about it by reading the papers. Cameron's reaction was quoted by the newspapers. "It's all news to me, and I cannot believe it is true," was Cameron's quote. Now that was the end of the block quote. Later, Mr. Bennett's story appeared in abbreviated form in True magazine. The above quotation appeared on page 125 of that magazine for October 1951. I give the reader this information in order that he may read what follows without the risk of any deception concerning the Ford apology, says Smith. To summarize, 1, the press quoted Mr. Ford as apologizing for the publication of the International Jew. 2, Mr. Ford told me in the presence of Mrs. Ford, Mrs. Smith, and Mr. Ernest Liebold, his secretary for 34 years, that he hoped to republish it and that he did not sign the apology. 3, Mr. Bennett, who at one time was one of the three most powerful individuals connected with the Ford Company, admits that Mr. Ford did not sign the apology, but that he, Bennett, copied Mr. Ford's signature with accuracy, and that this signature is the only one which appeared on the formal apology. Proof of that being in October 1951, True magazine. So Ford didn't apologize. The guy he worked with signed his name to it. As far as I'm concerned, says Smith, I am willing to base my conclusions relative to the report, the International Jew, on the personal statement which Mr. Ford made to me. Whatever the case may be, the report in its original form, as well as the abridged edition herewith, so they're calling it a report more than a book, since he charged or commissioned these people, his top researchers, with investigating the Jew as a problem worldwide. what they came back with is being called to report, and it was put out in booklet and newspaper and book form by various people over time. And he never formally rejected it or apologized. That is a myth circulated by the Jews, because they don't want any famous person associated with anti-Jewism, because others might follow that person, since someone like Ford was admired not only in America, but actually abroad in Germany by the people who went on to found and develop the Nazi Party. Pretty amazing, huh? You think of them coming after him. No, they came before that stuff. Right when Hitler was getting started, right before Hitler was getting started, he's just out of the army and he's looking around at all the different radical right-wing nationalist political groups, is when Ford is publishing in America the most damning stuff ever published against the Jews, although I know there was also a good deal of material in Germany in the 19th century that was produced, talking about a lot of the same stuff that you're going to find in the International Jew Publication Report. So, whatever the case may be, the report in its original form, as well as the abridged edition herewith, that's what we're going to read from, we are reading from, speaks for itself and is supported by the logic of its contents. Concerning the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, Mr. Ford said on February 17, 1921, "The only statement I care to make about the protocols is that they fit in with what is going on. They have fitted the world's situation up to this time. They fit it now." So the Jews are making the same whines that those are, they're a forgery, they're fiction, but he's saying, well, they fit what's going on. It must be observed that when Mr. Ford made this statement concerning the protocols in relationship to his publication, The International Jew, this document, which is allegedly the secret minutes of the elders of Zion, was only 16 years old. The Jews had advertised to the world that the protocols of the learned elders of Zion were forgeries. Mr. Ford wasted no time arguing this question. He merely said to his friends, "No matter what they are, they fit what is going on." Some students of the situation have pointed out that even the word forgery implies that the object referred to is an accurate reproduction of the original. For that reason, every student of the Jewish problem should have a copy of the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, which I do have a couple copies, and we will be reading that as well. Copies may be obtained by addressing orders to the Christian Nationalist Crusade, P.O. Box 27895, Los Angeles 27, California. I'm sure that's long dead. Price 50 cents. 50 cents back then. In his book entitled My Life and Work, which was published in 1922, right in the middle of this, Mr. Ford comments on his International Jew series with the following words, colon, long block quote here. "Readers of our," quote, "readers of our articles will see at once that we are not actuated by any kind of prejudice, except it may be a prejudice in favor of the principles which have made our civilization. There had been observed in this country certain streams of influence which were causing a marked deterioration in our literature, amusements, and social conduct. Business was departing from its old-time substantial soundness. A general letting down of standards were felt everywhere. It was not the robust coarseness of the white man, the rude indelicacy, say, of Shakespeare's characters, but a nasty Orientalism which has insidiously affected every channel of expression." A nasty Orientalism, he's referring to Jews, which has insidiously, secretly and destructively, affected every channel of expression, and to such an extent that it was time to challenge it. The fact that these influences are all traceable to one racial source is a fact to be reckoned with. Our work does not pretend to say the last word on the Jew in America. It says only the word which describes his present impress on this country. When that impress is changed, the report can be changed. That is, when the Jew stops doing what he's doing, then we won't accuse him of doing what he's doing. If he starts acting like Amish, no one will say a word against him. Our opposition is only to ideas, false ideas, which are sapping the moral stamina of the people. These ideas proceed from easily identified sources. They are promulgated by easily discoverable methods, and they are controlled by mere exposure.
me read that again.
Our opposition is only to ideas, false ideas, which are sapping the moral stamina of the people. These ideas proceed from easily identified sources. They are promulgated by easily discoverable methods, and they are controlled by mere exposure. And perhaps that's where the idea of exposing the Jew comes from. But exposing the Jew is not enough. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. But perhaps that's where that's sort of the first idea of exposing them from Smith in this introduction. Just as we saw stuff from Donald Day that would be used by others, the idea that anti-Semitism, besides being a bogus construct, is something carried by Jews and infecting others, the way blacks infect people with racism by their behavior. Bogus coinages used to transfer the problem from the person causing it to the one experiencing, enjoying, and perceiving it. Anyway, here's a quote as we come to the toward the end of the introduction by Gerald Smith. When people, and this is not from Smith, he's quoting it in his introduction, when people learn to identify the source and nature of the influence swirling around them, it is sufficient. So the idea of exposing the Jew as being sufficient comes from Ford. But of course, we know now it's not sufficient. Let the American people once understand that it is not natural degeneracy, but calculated subversion that afflicts us, and they are safe. So you have, the key here is that we're not doing this to ourselves. It is being done to us by an identifiable source, and that source is the Jews. So while James Burnham, kind of the intellectual forerunner of Samuel Francis, the head of the non-Jew right, is talking about suicide and the age of technocracy and the technocratic government, suicide of the West. In fact, it's a murder of the West through its poisoning and cultural subversion coming from Jews. They are doing it to us. That's the key thing to understand. It is calculated subversion, says Ford. Although, like Revelo P. Oliver, he betrays a naive trust that once the truth is exposed, the American people will bring the perpetrators to justice. That's what Revelo Oliver believed when he, after he went to work in Washington, D.C. and saw how thoroughly corrupt the Roosevelt administration was. He believed that the facts would come to life and America would essentially kick the bums out or control them somehow. But it didn't happen, so he was disabused of his naivete. And Ford is saying essentially, sort of a variant of the same thing about the Jews 20, 30 years earlier. 1920 versus, say, 1950. Both are wrong. Exposing the Jew is necessary but not sufficient. But, Ford says, the explanation is the cure. This work was taken up without personal motives. When it reached a stage where we believed the American people could grasp the key, we let it rest for the time. Our enemies say that we began it for revenge and that we laid it down in fear. Time will show that our critics, the Jews, are merely dealing in evasion because they dare not tackle the main question. Well, that's right, but they don't respond honestly because they can't. They are using pure power politics of murder, intimidation, subversion, and blackmail to cover what they're doing. They can't debate stuff honestly. They have only one recourse, and that's to suppress people pointing out what they're doing. This is why these endless appeals on the right for debate or acting like we're in a debate or we won't go that low. Well, guess what? They will go that low. Yeah, you're right. You won the debate, but there wasn't a debate, and it's not a debate. It's a fight. And until the other side starts fighting, and fighting doesn't mean just physically. It means intellectually. There's no chance of victory, let alone likelihood. There's no chance of it. Of course the Jews aren't going to debate. What are they going to say? Admit that they're doing it? What the vast majority of whites doesn't want? Heck no, they're not going to talk about that. They're going to keep suppressing, they're going to keep suborning opinion, essentially buying opinion mongers and putting them out before the public of every stripe of opinion to persuade them that to look away from the Jews and that you're a nut or that you're obsessed with conspiracy theory. It's funny that was even the word used in this. I was reading in Culture Wars about a fellow named I think his name was Holman. From Oregon, he lost to Morse, and Holman had the ADL against him because he went to the FBI and wanted them to investigate the ADL for doing a shady anti-American things, and in return they raised money and supported his opponent, and he lost even though he had been greatly favored. In fact, he lost in the Republican primary. And this was back in the 40s, and after he lost, he complained about it in the papers, and they chalked what he was saying up to bogus conspiracy theory. So, as I've always said, every technique that you find used today has been used a lot longer than you would ever imagine. There really isn't very, very little that's new under the sun, per the Bible verse. And Jews have been claiming that people who point out what they were doing are motivated by bad personal reasons, or are mentally crazy or morally insane or criminals or pursuing conspiracy theories, know that they're lying. They're deliberately trying to destroy their enemies because they can't debate them. Understand that. All right, concluding paragraph of the introduction from Gerald Smith. No mature-minded thinker, in fact, no honest reader, could question Mr. Ford's logic as summarized above. I agree completely with Mr. Ford in his expressed conviction that all America and the world needs to know the truth, and the truth shall set us free. So that's the somewhat naive, idealistic Goy idea that if we've taken straight from Jesus, that if we know the truth, we're going to be freed. No, if we know the truth, we simply know the truth. Knowledge is not power. Power is power. Knowledge may sometimes lead to power, make it easier to understand what's going on so that we may gain power, but knowledge in itself is really not power in most circumstances. And now we'll proceed to chapter 1. These are not super long chapters. It's not a super huge book or large book. Like I said, we'll do chapter 1 and 2 today. Actually, we've already been going for it. Let's just do chapter 1 today, and then we'll be on our way. So we'll just do the Jewish history in the United States, chapter 1. But there's a quote leading in from the 7th protocol of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. Quote, "We must force the Gentile governments to adopt measures which will promote our broadly conceived plan already approaching its triumphal goal by bringing to bear the pressure of stimulated public opinion, which has in reality been organized by us, with the help of the so-called great power of the press. With few exceptions, not worth considering, it has already fallen into our hands." So the Jews control the press and use that to manipulate public opinion to support their secret plan. That's what's going on. Okay, chapter 1, the Jewish history in the United States. The story of the Jews in America begins with Christopher Columbus. And now we're on page 13, and we'll go up through 8 through 18 is where chapter 1 ends, just so you have an idea. The story of the Jews in America begins with Christopher Columbus. On August 2nd, 1492, more than 300,000 Jews, 300,000 Jews, were expelled from Spain. 1492, the New World's discovered, and Jews are kicked out of Spain. And on August 3, the next day, Columbus set sail for the West, taking a group of Jews with him. So, early August, 1492, Columbus sails the ocean blue, as the old rhyme goes, and the Jews are kicked out of Spain, and Columbus has a group of Jews with him. They were not, however, refugees, for the prophetic navigator's plans had aroused the sympathy of influential Jews for a long period previously. Columbus himself tells us that he consorted much with Jews. The first letter he wrote detailing his discoveries was to a Jew. Indeed, the eventful voyage itself, which added to men's knowledge and wealth, quote, the other half of the earth, unquote, was made possible by Jews. The pleasant story that it was Queen Isabella's jewels which financed the voyage has disappeared under cool research. There are three Marranos, or secret Jews, who, those are like false converted Jews in Spain. That's the name of Jew converts in Spain, Marranos. There were three Marranos, or secret Jews, who wielded great influence at the Spanish court. Luis de Santangel, Santangel, S-A-N-T-A-G-E-L, G is pronounced H in Spanish, Luis de Santangel, who was an important merchant of Valencia, southern Spanish city, and who was a farmer of the royal taxes, traditional relation between Jews and the Catholic or noble elite in Spain is in Poland is the Jews are sort of the middle class, and they're tax farming the peasants for the Aryan royalty and coming to control them because they alone have the money that the Aryans need to conduct their endless wars. Luis de Sanahel, who is an important merchant of Valencia and who was farmer of the royal taxes, his relative, Gabriel Sanchez, who was a royal treasurer, and their friend, the royal chamberlain, Juan Cabrero. So Cabrero, Sanchez, and Sanahel. These worked unceasingly on Queen Isabella's imagination, picturing to her the depletion of the royal treasury and the likelihood of Columbus discovering the fabulous gold of the Indies, until the queen was ready to offer her jewels in pawn for the funds. But Sanahel craved permission to advance the money himself, which he did, 17,000 ducats in all, about 5,000 pounds, perhaps equal to 40,000 pounds today. Again, this is written in 1920. Associated with Columbus in the voyage were at least five Jews, Luis de Torres, the interpreter, Marco, the surgeon, Bernal, the physician, Alonso de la Calle, C-A-L-L-E, Calle means street in Spanish, Alonso de la Calle, and Gabriel Sanchez. Luis de Torres, T-O-R-R-E-S, was the first man ashore, the first to discover the use of tobacco. He settled in Cuba and may be said to be the father of Jewish control of the tobacco business as it exists today. Their interpreter, the Jew named Luis de Torres, founds tobacco in Cuba. Was actually the first one ashore. Columbus's old patrons, Luis de Sanahel and Gabriel Sanchez, received many privileges for the part they played in the work, but Columbus himself became the victim of a conspiracy fostered by Bernal, the ship's doctor, and suffered injustice and imprisonment as his reward. From that beginning, Jews looked more and more to America as a fruitful field, and immigration set in strongly toward South America, principally Brazil. But because of military participation in a disagreement between the Brazilians and the Dutch, the Jews of Brazil found it necessary to emigrate, which they did in the direction of the Dutch colony of what is now New York. Peter Stuyvesant, the Dutch governor, you hear Bedford Stuy, that's Stuyvesant, this is the original that comes from, Peter Stuyvesant or Stuyvesant, the Dutch governor did not entirely approve of their settling among his people and ordered them to leave, and there's written material to that effect. I've seen it even cited by Jews writing about the history of Jews in America. So these Jews come up from South America to New York, was kind of the first settlement of Jews in the U.S., I believe. But the Jews had evidently taken the precaution to assure their being received, if not welcome, because upon revoking the order of Stuyvesant, the directors gave as one of the reasons for the Jews being received, quote, the large amount of capital which they have invested in the shares of the company, unquote. So they're using money to get themselves into places where they're really not wanted. Nevertheless, they were forbidden to enter public service and to open retail shops, which had the effect of driving them into foreign trade, in which they were soon exercising all but a monopoly because of their European connections. This is only one of the thousand illustrations which can be given of the resourcefulness of the Jew. Forbidden in one direction, he will excel in another. When he was forbidden to deal in new clothes, he sold old clothes. That was the beginning of the organized traffic in secondhand clothing. When he was forbidden to deal in merchandise, he dealt in waste. The Jew is the originator of the waste product business of the world. He was the originator of the salvage system. He found wealth in the debris of civilization. He taught people how to use old rags, how to clean old feathers, how to use gall nuts and rabbit skins. He has always had a taste for the furrier trade, which he now controls, and to him is due the multitude of common skins which now pass under various alluring trade names as furs of high origin. So they're selling lower-end furs as higher-end ones or coming up with new brand names to persuade people of their value. Saying Jews are very resourceful as well as cunning. And if they're shut out in one area, they're going to work hard in another area. That's something white nationalists could definitely learn from. Unwittingly, old Peter Stuyvesant compelled the Jews to make New York the principal port of America, and though a majority of New York Jews had fled to Philadelphia at the time of the American Revolution, most of them returned to New York at the earliest opportunity, instinct seeming to make them aware that in New York was to be their principal paradise of gain, and so it is proved. So he says, a majority of New York Jews had fled to Philadelphia at the time of the American Revolution. Most of them returned to New York when they got the chance, and that became their kind of their world capital. New York is the greatest center of Jewish population in the world. It is the gateway where the bulk of American imports and exports are taxed, and where practically all the business done in America pays tribute to the masters of money. The very land of the city is the holdings of the Jews. No wonder that Jewish writers, viewing this unprecedented prosperity, this unchecked growth in wealth and power, exclaim enthusiastically that the United States is the promised land foretold by the prophets, and New York the new Jerusalem. Some have even gone further and described the peaks of the Rockies as the mountains of Zion, and with reason, too, if the mining and coastal wealth of the Jews is considered. In the time, Jews in Business is a subtitle, as we move on to page 16. In the time of George Washington, there were about 4,000 Jews in the country, and most of them well-to-do traders. They favored the American side and helped the revolutionary colonies out with loans at critical moments. In 50 years, and again, this is only, 150 years before they're writing this, it's 1776 versus 1920. In 50 years, the traceable increase in the Jewish population of the U.S. was more than 3,300,000. What it is today, no man can estimate with any hope of accuracy. Now, that's an interesting point. To make a list of the lines of business controlled by the Jews of the United States would be to touch most of the vital industries of the country, those which are really vital, and those which cultivated habit have been made to seem vital. The theatrical business is exclusively Jewish. Play producing, booking, theater operation are all in the hands of the Jews. This accounts for the fact that in almost every production today can be detected propaganda, sometimes glaringly commercial advertisement, sometimes direct political instruction. Again, 1920, they're saying this. The motion picture industry, the sugar industry, the tobacco industry, 50% or more of the meatpacking industry, over 60% of the shoemaking industry, most of the musical purveying done in the country, jewelry, grain, cotton, oil, steel, magazine authorship, news distribution, the liquor business, the loan business, these, to name only the industries with national and international sweep, are in the control of Jews of the United States, either alone or in association with Jews overseas. So he's saying Jews are controlling all these things. Cotton, oil, steel, grain, jewelry, magazines, music, tobacco, sugar. Whatever is international, the Jews are controlling it alone or with people, other Jews they know abroad. The American people would be vastly surprised if they could see a lineup of some of the, quote, American businessmen who hold up our commercial prestige overseas. They are mostly Jews. This may throw a sidelight on the regard in which, quote, American business methods, unquote, are held in some parts of the world. When many different races of people can carry on business under the name, quote, American, unquote, and do it legally, too, it is not surprising that Americans do not recognize some of the descriptions of the American methods which appear in the foreign press. If the reputation of American business has suffered, it is because something other than American methods have been used under the American name. Instances of Jewish prosperity in the United States are commonplace, but prosperity, the just reward of foresight and application, is not to be confounded with control. It would be impossible for any Gentile coalition under similar circumstances to attain the control which the Jews have won, for the reason that there is lacking in the Gentile a certain quality of working togetherness, a certain conspiracy of objective, and the adhesiveness of intense raciality, which characterizes the Jew. So he's saying Gentiles couldn't do what Jews did because they don't work together. With their conspiracy of objective, the adhesiveness of intense raciality. You see, they're tightly bound as a race, whereas we are not. It is nothing to a Gentile that another man is a Gentile. It is next to everything to a Jew that the man at his door is another Jew. And that's the fundamental understanding about Jews. We Aryans who don't know any better judge them as just other people with a different religion, but in fact they're racially bound very tightly together, that they may be said to operate as a team. The international Jewish plan to move their money market to the United States was what the American people did not want. We have the warning of history as to what this means. It has meant in turn that Spain, Venice, Germany, or Great Britain received the blame or suspicion of the world for what Jewish financiers have done. It is a most important consideration that most of the national animosities that exist today arose out of resentment against what Jewish money power did under the camouflage of national names. So they say this happened in South Africa, but it's actually Jews operating out of a bank in England under the name of British. You see, Jews are creating all these animosities, but they're not known as Jews, and the people, British, Germans, French, whatever, receive the blame. The British did this. The Germans did this. When it was the international Jew who did it, the nations being but the marked spaces on his checkerboard. Today, around the world, the blaming word is heard, quote, "The United States did this. If it were not for the United States, the world would be in a better shape. The Americans are a sordid, greedy, cruel people," unquote. And funny, he's right, you could say the same thing today, and it's nearly 100 years later. Why? Because the Jewish money power is centered here and is making money out of both our immunity and Europe's distress, playing one against the other, and because so many so-called American businessmen abroad today are not Americans at all, they are Jews. Citizens wake up with a start to find that even the white nations are hardly allowed to see each other nowadays except through Jewish eyes. Great Britain and France seldom see an American spokesman who is not a Jew. That may be the reason why they reciprocate by sending Jews to us, thinking perhaps we prefer them. And that is the end of chapter 1. Since that was fairly quick, let's go on with I better not. I better say that. We'll just call that an end. We did the introduction. We did chapter 1 of the International Jew. We'll be back real soon again at vnnforum.com with chapter 2, which is Angles of Jewish Influence. My name is Alex Linder. You can find everything that I've written, done, said at vnnforum.com. Follow me on Twitter at the Linder Files, and I'll be back again with you very soon. We'll have more reading out of The International Jew by Henry Ford. Thanks for listening to me today. I'll be back with you again shortly.